Thanks again. Well, the 50th day is fast closing in on us. And of course, the 50th day, as you probably recognize and realize, is the day of Pentecost. And for the record, let's turn back to Leviticus, the 23rd chapter, which lists all the holy days and explains how we get to the 50th day. Leviticus, the 23rd chapter, today, by the way, is the 42nd day, which is 8 days away from the 50th day, if my math is correct. I did take math or arithmetic, as we called it back in the early days, but I never cared much for it, so hey. But I do know that it's 8 more days. At any rate, in Leviticus, the 23rd chapter, we'll begin in verse 15. And it says, "And you shall count for yourselves from the day after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering." Now, that was done up in verse 11. He said, the priest shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted on your behalf on the day after the Sabbath. The priest shall wave it. And it says, 7 Sabbaths shall be completed. In the finish, verse 15, 7 Sabbaths shall be completed. And 7 times 7, and here's another mathematical equation, 7 times 7, I think, is still 49, right? I thought so. So the title of my message is The 49th Day. And I'll get to that hopefully before the end of the sermon so that you can know what I'm actually talking about. But at any rate, it says in verse 16, count 50 days to the day after the 7th Sabbath. Now, how do we know which day the Sabbath was that we started counting from? Well, that particular day, if we reckon back, if we're after the 7th Sabbath, that's a fixed date on the calendar, where if we were using the first or the last Sabbath or day of unleavened bread, it's not a fixed spot. We would be randomly all over the calendar. And so it has to be a fixed spot, so it has to be the Sabbath, during the days of unleavened bread. This particular year, it ended up being the first day of unleavened bread, and that's where the counting was reckoned from. But anyway, the 49th day is the title. Pentecost, as we know and have recognized for a long time, and logically so, is always associated in our minds with the Holy Spirit. Because on that day, the church was born, according to the biblical record, and the Holy Spirit was given. So that's why it's associated with the Holy Spirit, because that happened. In Acts, the first chapter, and we'll fast forward here to Acts, the first chapter, it describes that. Actually, in the second chapter is when it really happened, but what we want to look at is in the first chapter, in Acts 1. But the Holy Spirit was given back in the early days of the church, in the Old Testament days of the church. They might have recognized it as the day that the law was given, or the wave sheaf, and so forth, were more associated with it. Obviously, the Holy Spirit hadn't been generally given. Some people had it, but in general, it was not widespread like it was after the first Pentecost, after Christ had been resurrected. But in the first chapter of, if you're on the Bible reading program that we're on right now, you read this sometime earlier in May, probably, I guess. Maybe it started, did it start in April? Maybe. But anyway, since it's the first chapter, it probably started early in the program, I guess. So you've probably read it. We want to look at verses 4 and 5. Verse 4, it said, "And being assembled together with them, he commanded them to not depart from Jerusalem." Now he was Christ, and they were the apostles, and there could have been other people, others there as well, other than the 12. Well, at this point, there were only 11 apostles because they had not anointed or ordained Matthias yet to be the 12th apostle to replace Judas Iscariot, who had taken his life, actually, and had betrayed Jesus Christ, and then the events that followed that. But anyway, being assembled together with them, he commanded them not to depart from Jerusalem, but to wait. Now, you can probably just imagine and almost hear it in your mind, Peter saying, "Wait? Why should we wait? Why do we need to wait?" As impetuous and impatient as Peter seemed to be, or was, or a lot of the Gospels, when we read the Gospels, he sort of comes across that way. You can just think about, and there's a little bit of evidence that we'll just look at briefly here, just mention in a moment. But I'm guessing that they might, in their minds, have thought, "Why should we wait? Why wait? For," it's continuing, "for the promise of the Father, which he said, you've heard from me," because he talked about it before. "For John truly baptized with water, but you shall be baptized with the Holy Spirit not many days from now." And this is, again, I don't know that they knew when it was going to be. Just he didn't indicate, at least here, when it was going to be, just some days from now, in the future here. Again, they probably thought, why wait? And one of the reasons we think that is because, look in verse 6. "Therefore, when they had come together and asked him, saying, Lord," they wanted everything now, instantly. They wanted it. They didn't want to wait. "Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel?" Because that's what they had been thinking the whole ministry of Jesus Christ. At every opportune time, they had thought, this is it. This is when it's going to happen. All the way through Jesus' crucifixion, they thought that same thing. Well, of course, he said, "It's not for you to know the times or the seasons, but that the Father has put in his own authority." But waiting is not something that most of us like to do. Waiting is one of those things that sort of can be, sometimes is, maybe shouldn't be, aggravating and unpleasant. We may feel that way. I know I probably do at times. We want things, and we want it now. We don't want to wait. We live in an instant gratification world, an instant response world. When at work, when somebody emails me or however they contact me, or my office contacts me to contact somebody, it is our policy to respond within, at the very least, 24 hours. But if I have not responded back to somebody in an hour, there's a good chance that I will get another email saying, "Oh, did you get my email? Did you hear? Can you tell me this, or can you find out that?" Because people are used to, people are conditioned to get things now. We get our news that way. When I was a kid, a young boy growing up, we obviously lived on an Amish farm. We got our news, the Worcester Daily Record, in the mail, which was a day and a half behind when it had been published. But to us, it was still news. But we got it late. Now that would not be acceptable. It would be totally unacceptable. Now, there were some things that were an inconvenience, but because the time we read the weather report, the weather that they were talking about was already past, because they were looking at the next day. But now we get our mail, or our news rather, online. A lot of people, I don't know if who all still waits for the news to come on, the 6 o'clock news or the weather or whatever. I know people do, but I would say a majority of people do not. When I want the weather, I go on my smartphone, click on my weather app, and I get up to the minute weather report. Sort of the same way with the news. I can get it almost instantaneously. Just click on one of several apps I have, and away we go, and I have the news. I can be caught up almost instantly. We have everything instant, from instant potatoes to instant messaging. It's the wide spectrum of everything instant, everything now, everything at our fingertips. And I'm not saying any of that or all of that's bad. Some things probably are, but I'm not suggesting that they are. But it just points out something. We're not used to waiting. We are not used to having a delay in getting things. We have not as much patience as we probably used to have, because we don't have to have as much patience. And waiting and patience are not a function of life. In fact, I'm almost surprised that anybody buys anything off of Amazon, because they have to wait till the next day to get it. And most people want it now, today. But at any rate, there is virtue in patience and waiting. It's one of the eight virtues of 2 Peter 1. We won't turn there, but it's one of those things that he listed as a virtue. He called it perseverance. And perseverance is actually one of the words, there are two Greek words that are translated patience or long-suffering in the Bible, in the Word of God, in the New Testament. And I'm not going to belabor what those two words are, but they're mostly translated either patience or long-suffering. And what they mean, they're very synonymous. They're almost alike. They're very closely associated because they have nuances of differences, but mostly fairly well alike, fairly closely alike. And they mean patient endurance. Today, what I want to talk about is waiting on God, or having patient endurance, which, again, it's a biblical, it's a virtue, and it is something that is waning in this life. Patience or long-suffering is actually a fruit of God's Spirit. Galatians 5:22. We go there so many times that there's a little path worn in our mind getting there, I think. Galatians 5 and verse 22, we probably can know what it says before we get there. It lists many of the works of the flesh first, from verse 19 to 21. The works of the flesh, which are these, and then it goes on to list many of them, adultery and so on, all the way down to revelries and the like, and many in between, the works of the flesh. But it says the fruits of the Spirit, or the fruit of the Spirit is, and then it starts listing them, love, joy, peace, and then here's the word, long-suffering. And it means, basically, as I mentioned, patient endurance, long-suffering. It is one of the fruits of the Spirit that was given on the day of Pentecost. Fruit, though, has to grow, and it has to develop. It is not automatic. I know, and I think this was alluded to maybe in the sermonette, when I got baptized, when many of us got baptized, we thought we had hit the jackpot, that we were in nirvana, that now everything is going to be different, everything is going to be easy, everything is going to be automatic. Well, I'm here to tell you, and so are most of you, that that is not the case. Oftentimes, because we're now that little focal point of light, it actually becomes more difficult because Satan is now targeting us in a way that he may not have been in a former life or in our former conduct, in our former way of conducting our life, because now all of a sudden we're the target. So keep that in mind, that it's not automatic, that just because we have God's Spirit does not mean we have a full extension or a full or patience to the full extent. All of those things listed in verse 22 of Galatians 5 have to be developed, and they have to grow, and they have to be continued to be worked on and worked at. James, though, the book of James in chapter 5, has a formula for developing patience that's built around three illustrations that he gives. But on the way to James 5, let's stop by James chapter 1 and just get a little bit of a glimpse of how important that patience actually is. James 1, and it says he wrote this to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad. And of course they were. If we know anything of the history of Israel and Judah, we know that they had been dispersed, Judah to Babylon, although they had come back, some of them, not all of them, had come back to the land of Judea, to Jerusalem, and that area to rebuild the temple in preparation so that eventually about, I think, 400 and some years later, Jesus Christ could be born in their land in Bethlehem, and then could have a ministry in that area, in Palestine and around that area. So they had to be there so that could happen. But anyway, besides that, I digress. It says in verse 2 of chapter 1 of James, it says, and I love the book of James because James gives us a lot of practical things that we can use. They're easy, they're clear, easy to understand. They're applications that we can put to use, and they bear fruit. They bear results. And he makes them clear. My brethren, he said, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. The apostles, when they were put in prison in Acts 5 in verse 41, it said they rejoiced that they were able to, that they were accounted worthy to suffer for the name of Christ. And this is what James is saying. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. It produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. Patience perfects character. It perfects us. It takes trials, actually, to do that, as referenced in verse 2 and 3. It takes trials to perfect our patience. But it's extremely important, as pointed out here and other places, that we need to have patient endurance, that we need to continue to work on it and make it grow. In James 5, which is better known probably for the prayer of the righteous effecting healing and so on, which is at the very end of the chapter, but that's not what we want to look at. We're looking at the three illustrations or examples that James gave that we can look to help our patience continue to grow, the fruit of the Spirit, patience, to help it to continue to grow and to become better, and that's what we are to do. He said, therefore, in verse 7, we'll go from 7 to 11, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. And then he gets to the first thing, the first illustration. He said, see how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth. And there's that word waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and the latter rain. The early and the latter rain may not be exactly what we think it is. I would think the early rain would be the spring rain, latter rain would be the fall rain, but it's actually, in reality, just the opposite in this case. The early rains are the fall rain that they plant seeds in the fall that overwinter, and then they have to have rain to get a good start. And then in the spring, they have the latter rains to continue, for that to continue to grow. At any rate, continuing on in verse 8, you also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brethren, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. We're being judged now. This is our time of judging. My brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Here's the second illustration. Take the prophets. Look at the example of the prophets, he's saying, as an example of suffering and patience. Then verse 11 has the last item in it. It says, indeed, we count them blessed who endure. You have heard of the patience, in this case it's translated perseverance, which is that same word. You have heard of the patience of Job. And I'm sure that's almost a common reference in our language today, the patience of Job. Boy, he has the patience of Job and so on, because if somebody is very patient in something and we notice it. You have heard of the patience of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord. There was a reason for what happened to Job, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. Those three, the farmers, the prophets, and then Job. We're going to take a look at all three of those in just a little bit of, not a great deal of detail, but in some detail, to see if we can find out anything that would help us to build on and grow this fruit of the Spirit that we have, and to help it to grow and maximize it, this fruit of the Spirit called patience, long-suffering. The first one, we'll take them in order, and the first one, of course, is the farmers. Now, there are many examples in the Bible of farmers. Or of agricultural items. Everything from last week we heard the sermon about the sower and the seed. And in Matthew, from Matthew 13, that's one example. There's the wheat and the tares, which is also in that same chapter in Matthew 13. Now these, the sower and the seed are both listed in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. I don't think it's in John, but it's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, because John had a little different approach to what he put down, what he wrote for us to know. But there's, as I mentioned, the wheat and the tares, and in John also referenced the agricultural things. He said the harvest in chapter 4, where he's talking about with the Samaritan woman at the well. He mentions then to his disciples when they came back and joined him that, look, he said, the fields are already white for harvest. And references to agricultural things are one of the most common things that we will read in the New Testament, in the Gospels, because people of that day, and we still can know what that means, because we look outside, there are trees growing. Well, he talked about fig trees. And we see plants. And even in the Old Testament, remember the plant that came up and shaded Jonah that he was angry about when God created a worm and it took it away? Well, those are all agricultural references and analogies. Farmers, I don't know, how many farmers do we have or have people who have ever worked on a farm or been on a farm? How many do we have in here? We have, I don't know why they're all sitting on the right side, or actually on my right side, on the left side. There, I don't see any on the left, my left. But anyway, they also know pretty much what we're talking or what we'll be talking about. But farmers have a hard job to do. And it takes a lot of patience. Right now, we have a decent-sized garden. And right now, I'm having to fight a lot of patience. I'm trying to build patience, and it's I'm given something to work with. Because my garden, we planted it. It came up pretty nicely, but then the rains came, and now it's practically underwater. I don't know if it's going to survive or if I'm going to have to replant or if I'm going to have to do without those homegrown vegetables this summer. We'll see. But it does take a lot of patience to be a farmer. The first thing you have to do is you have to prepare the soil. And last week we talked about, or the message was talking about the good soil. And it talked a little bit about the preparation of that good soil, how what it takes to prepare the soil. Well, you can't just throw some seed out and hope it grows. There are things, if you want a crop or a decent crop or a good crop, you have to do the things that it takes to prepare your soil to be a good crop. They say, or an old farming saying is, healthy soil, healthy people. And that's probably true. The healthier the soil in an area is, the healthier the people in that area are. In our area, we're very, very blessed in northern Ohio, and in fact, in most of Ohio, because this area, you can see it almost by driving through. The people look fairly wealthy because, or successful, and it's because the soil in this area has always been so good. When the first settlers came here, there was about 3 or 2.5 to 3 feet of topsoil in this area. And it's not that anymore. I think we're probably lucky to have 7 or maybe 6 on an average of topsoil left. Through erosion, through a lot of different reasons, plants not replenishing the nutrients in the soil and so on, as we've harvested things and taken out, we've done a lot more mining of things out of the soil than we have replacing it or having an eco-friendly and a soil that is, or in farming, that is friendly to the soil in our area, but this area was blessed with some really good resources. People in general, I'll just make a little commentary about this area. People sometimes want to get away from this area. Are you listening, Julie? She's my daughter. She wanted because it's cold. And, you know, there are more enticing areas, and can't really blame her, but at any rate, people want to get away because they think of all those things, but we have some of the best weather year-round. We have 4 seasons. We don't have earthquakes to speak of. Once in a while, a little tremor. We don't have a lot up in northeastern Ohio, especially a lot of tornadoes. We did have a little bit of one last week, but in general, we don't have much. We don't have poisonous insects and snakes much up here. So I think it's a pretty good area. So that's my commercial for the day for the Chamber of Commerce to try to get people to come to this area, I guess. But at any rate, farmers have to prepare that soil to be ready for the plants that are coming, to be ready to plant it. Then the next thing they have to do is they have to plant the seed. They have to, in what we used to do when growing up on the farm, so I know a little bit about farming, what we used to do, we'd have corn, we'd have hay, then corn, then oats, then wheat, then it reverted back to hay. We had a 4-year rotation, kept the bugs down, kept the diseases out of our plants, and kept the fertility in it, because certain things thrive on what other plants, for example, corn needs nitrogen, so wheat and hay provide nitrogen, so that's good for corn. So that obviously it follows that way. But anyway, you have to plant your soil that you've prepared with good seed. The sower sowed good seed in Matthew 13. If he hadn't, it wouldn't have had a chance. But you have to have good seed, then you have to cultivate it. And I know there's people that have done cultivating with hose in this room, I'm sure. And it's not easy work. But you know what all of this takes? Takes a lot of patience. We have to be patient because we put that seed in, even into good soil. Takes a while. I was cultivating. I've told this story probably many times. You may be tired of hearing it, but I was cultivating our corn. We tried to get it cultivated about three times, sometimes four if the weather was just right. We cultivated it when it was real small, and then it got bigger, and then it got bigger again, because the bigger it got, the more we could hill the corn up against the, or the dirt and soil up against the stalks of corn. And I, one morning, we did it with two horses and a manual cultivator, or a horse-drawn cultivator, and it would put the dirt in. You had these little pedals that you did to avoid the corn, so that if your cultivator drifted this way or that, you could still keep from dislodging the corn. One morning, it was a Monday morning, and I had probably been out a little too late on Sunday night, and I was probably should have been home in bed. But at any rate, I started to cultivate. And this little corn is, you know, maybe 3 inches high or whatever. And you go down this row and you have to look down to keep it from, well, that corn going by is better than counting sheep. It puts you right to sleep. And well, and when I woke up, I was going diagonal across the field. And my dad was not very happy, but we recovered. But anyway, those are some of the things that can happen, along with natural disasters such as the rain that's coming now. Or there can be hail, which can damage a crop. There can be all kinds of storms. There can be drought, not enough water, and so on. Finally, as you're working on the farm, finally you get to the harvest, and you hope that your crop produces, as was mentioned in one parable, I forget which one it was, but you know, some 30, some 50, and some 100 or whatever. You hope your crop is the maximum crop for that year. And if you've done everything right, the weather has cooperated, it can be. But it takes a long time and a lot of work. You might start out in April, if the weather is good, getting in your field and not harvest a crop till November. That's not long in, you know, as compared to a millennium or anything, but it's long in terms of a life, a whole 6 months perhaps. So it takes patience. And when we think about that, if we have projects, let's say we're trying to do Bible study and learn more about the Bible, it takes time. It doesn't happen overnight. It takes a while for us to actually accomplish things and get those things in our mind. But they're goals that we can reach on a short term or an intermediate term. That's what this one is. An illustration of a short or intermediate term development of patience. The next one is a more long term illustration, and that's the patience of the prophets. When we think about the prophets, and we probably rarely think of them in this way as patience, but that's what James said, it's a great illustration of long-term patience, developing long-term patience. When we look at the prophets and when we glean from them some of the things that James said we can learn from them, and patience, long-suffering is one of them. I'll give you some examples. Isaiah, who was a prophet to Judah, prophesied for between 30 and 40 years. He was basically clothed in probably sort of the uniform of prophets, sackcloth. And it's not called sackcloth necessarily, but it's called a coarse or goat's hair, mostly coarse goat's hair, which a lot of the prophets wore. Elijah, for example, was described that way. John the Baptist was described that way. He wore camel skin or camel hair and so forth. And their indications are that a lot of the prophets wore that type of clothing. It sort of reminds me of burlap when you look at it a little bit. It's coarse, and it probably is itchy. And I would guess it'd be hot in the summer and maybe cold in the winter and so forth. But it's sort of a coarse hair garment that they wore. Isaiah wore it. It says in verse 20 and verse 2 is where we see that. Jeremiah. And Jeremiah was called the weeping prophet, and he was a prophet to the nations. He was a Levite. Apparently not all of the prophets were Levites, but some of them probably were. But anyway, Jeremiah was forbidden to marry, and he prophesied for 40 to 50 years. Now, how would you like to stand here and tell somebody how wrong they are and how bad they are for 40 years? They didn't take kindly to it. None of them did. They did a lot of things to Jeremiah. They put him in prison. They put him in a slime pit or a pit full of muck of some kind that he was probably up to his waist or beyond, maybe his chest, stuck in this, and he could hardly move, let alone lie down. I don't know how he would do that. And he was in stocks. They put him in stocks. Now, I was in stocks one time, and that was only to take a picture. We went to the feast one time in the Williamsburg, Virginia area, and we went to Colonial Williamsburg, and on the square, or on the town center, what do they call them, the commons, town commons, in the middle of Williamsburg, they had a stock there where people, I think the thing just lifted up and down. But when they put him in stock, he couldn't move. He couldn't get out. He couldn't do anything. But here, you'd put your hands through there, and it clamped. A wooden piece looked like a yoke came down over your two arms at the wrist, and then your head was in there as well. And the same. It was all one piece covered that. And then all you had to do was stand up to get out of it. But in Jeremiah's case, that wasn't what it was like. He was put in stocks. I don't know. I can't remember, or I don't even know if it says how long he was in there. But for some period of time, he was in stocks, where he was probably made fun of. Maybe they threw rotten tomatoes at him, or whatever they did. But that's where they put people to ridicule, mock him, and so on and so forth. And he experienced that as well. Ezekiel, he prophesied for 20 to 30 years. By the way, Jeremiah, it's also said of him that he was probably almost a lifelong martyr for all the things that happened to him. He was like a living martyr almost his whole life. But Ezekiel, he prophesied for 20 to 30 years. He also was a Levite. But he did his prophecies from, of all things, captivity in Babylon. He had been carried away with, I believe, the first wave of captives that were taken from Jerusalem when the Babylonians came along. And they had taken him along with Daniel and his friends. I think Dave Ritter said Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, along with his friends. He had been carried off to Babylon. And that's where he did his prophesying from. He was a watchman for Israel. He had to lay on his left side for 390 days on his left side. Now, I don't suppose that he was lying on his left side day and night. I would guess it was only nights, but for a long period of time. And then, as if that wasn't enough, the next he had to lie on his right side for 40 days. I think that was to straighten out his back from laying on his left side, maybe. But no, it was also to show something to the nations. He was a watchman for Israel. And these two occurrences were to show the nations of Judah and Israel, the northern house of Israel, to show them things. That was his life, 20 to 30 years of it. Then Daniel, which is where we're going to go next, we're going to go to the book of Daniel. Daniel spent almost his entire life in captivity. He, as a youth, a lot of people feel he was probably maybe 16 years old or so when he was taken, carried off captive. He was Jewish. He was of royal blood through the family of Hezekiah and his offspring. He was part of that lineage. And he came there at an early age, and he never got to go back to Judea. Never got back to Jerusalem where he came from. He had to spend his whole life in captivity. Now, obviously, as we know, he worked his way up. He was one of those people, a friend of God, who stood for what he believed in. If he believed something, he did it, no matter the consequences. And I think there's a big lesson there, as well as from his friend Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, for us today, to stand up for what we believe. Daniel, God helped him, and of course Daniel succeeded, even in turmoil. But when he came, he said, "I'm not eating the food." So he convinced his captors to let him try vegetables for 10 days to see how he would fare. And of course we know that he did better than all of those around him that were eating the king's food. He spent time overnight in the lion's den, standing up for what he believed in. He prayed 3 times a day. And when the edict went out that you're the only to pray to this statue we made, Daniel still prayed 3 times a day. And of course, he prayed towards Jerusalem, and window was open and they could see what he was doing, so they arrested him and put him in the lion's den. We know how that came out because he ended up surviving that. He was an interpreter of dreams and visions. God worked with Daniel. But can you imagine spending 80 years or so in captivity, 80 years, depending on how old he got? But he was probably, according to some chronologies, probably at least in his 80s or close to 80, the last we hear of him. But in Daniel, we're going to go to Daniel, the 10th chapter, which is what I want to point out here. Don't think I forgot about the 49th day, because I haven't. It's coming. Daniel 10. Here's another. He had, just before this, he had had what's called the 70 weeks prophecy. And then here he had had another prophecy, and or he had been given another vision or prophecy. He'd seen, obviously, the 70 weeks prophecy and also the beast rising up out of the sea. And then in verse 1 of chapter 10, it says, "In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia," and this must have been close or near the end of his life, or towards the end of his life, "a message was revealed to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar. The message was true, but the appointed time was long." It was for way down the road. "And it grieved Daniel." In fact, in those days, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. That's 21 days he was mourning. "I ate no pleasant food, no meat or wine came into my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all till 3 whole weeks were fulfilled." We're getting to the interesting part. "Now on the 24th day of the first month," which was, 10 days, I think, after Passover or something like that. 10 days after the Passover. "As I was by the side of the great river Tigris," that is the Tigris, "I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose waist was girded with gold of Euphath." A man was standing there, and he had some companions with him, which they got terrified and they fled, or or passed out or something happened to him. The men who were with me did not see the vision, but a great terror fell upon them so that they fled to hide themselves. Yeah. Somebody is coming now to give him the interpretation and the answer to the question that he'd been wanting, and he'd been fasting and praying for 21 days for this, and finally it came. And verse 11 says, Daniel, man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak. Verse 12, here's something pretty interesting. It said, do not fear, Daniel, for from the first day that your prayer, that you offered up a prayer, the very first day, on day one of the 21, that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard. Well, why were they not, if they were heard, didn't he come on the very first day and explain this all to him, and he could have saved Daniel the trouble of fasting or afflicting himself for 3 whole weeks, 21 days. Well, here's why. The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days, and behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. This is sort of interesting. It gives us a little bit of an insight into the spirit world. There may be a lot more turmoil going on than what we realize behind the scenes, because he said, the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me. This was not a good spirit. This was an evil spirit of some kind that withstood him. Daniel had the patience to continue to seek an answer till he got one. We probably should take a cue from that and probably do the same thing. We could probably learn something from it by not giving up, but to have the patience to wait on God and God's time. Even though God had heard and sent the angel, the messenger, right away, Daniel didn't get the answer until 21 days, 21 days later. There are some other little references here and there to the activity that goes on around us that we have no idea is happening and going on. In 2 Kings 6, Elisha, the prophet, we won't turn there, but Elisha the prophet, he had gone to a city called Dothan, and it was in Israel. Syria was fighting against Israel at that time, and they said, why can we not get, to the king of Israel? Why can't we do anything? And one of his servants said, well, Elisha, the prophet, he says, he knows what you say in your bedroom. Now, we could have surveillance techniques like that today, but they couldn't in those days. But that's what they told him. He knows what you whisper in your bedroom. He said, well, the king of Syria said, well, go get him. Go fetch him for me. Grab him and go. Where's he at? And he's in the town of Dothan. And so the next morning, Elisha woke up, and Elisha's servant, they were surrounded with armies. The army of Syria was around him. And his servant was really alarmed. What are we going to do? So Elisha prayed and he asked God, he said, open the eyes of my servant and let him see what's really going on around here. And when he opened his eyes, the whole mountain around him was filled with fires of chariots. They were there all the time, but he couldn't see them. We can't see what's going on. And sometimes maybe the answers that we're looking for, maybe there are reasons why we're not receiving the answer that are beyond our comprehension, like this, like the 21 days here of Daniel, or like the chariots of fire of Elisha. Maybe there are things going on around us that if we knew would be a lot more encouraging than they are because we can't see them. Maybe there are. It's just a little illustration of what is happening or going on that we don't really have insight into at this point. But we want to find the conclusion of this matter with Daniel. Daniel 4 says, you, Daniel, I'm sorry, chapter 12 in verse 4. My apologies. Daniel 12, verse 4, just another page or two over. It says, you, Daniel, shut up the words. He gave him all the information about the message. But he said, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. Then in verse 13, which is the last chapter, or the last verse in the book of Daniel, the last verse in this chapter and in the book, says it to Daniel, but you, Daniel, you go your way till the end, for you shall rest and will arise to your inheritance at the end of days. Now, this is another, if we ever have a discussion with someone who thinks that people are going to heaven immediately, this is another one that we can pull out of our arsenal of information to use to show that people do not go to heaven, because Daniel certainly would be one of God's saints. But anyway, he told him, no, you go your way. You're not going to see what happens. This is not going to happen. It's for a long time off. You're not going to see anything. You know partly about it a little bit, but he probably didn't have a complete comprehension of it even then, because it probably will not be opened up until the time of the end. Some of this information won't. This is the second illustration. It's a long-term example. All of these folks, all of these Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and most of the other Zechariah and Zephaniah and all the other Haggai, all of those folks did not really get to see. Most of them spent probably the greater portion of their life as a prophet in giving prophecy, and in most cases giving bad news to their own country or to whoever they were addressing. But they hung in there, and most of them, rarely any of them, actually saw the outcome of what they were talking about. But they had the patience, the long-suffering, to continue on. And when we get discouraged, when we think about, well, is this ever going to work out? Is anything ever going to happen? Think back to some of those prophets and to their ministry and to their life and what they experienced and what they suffered. Read Hebrews 11, the faith chapter. There's much more listed in there about specific things that happened to people. They were sawn asunder. They were put in prison. There were all kinds of evil and terrible things happened to them, but they had the faith and they had the courage and they had the determination to go on and to complete the job till the end. It can give us encouragement when we look at it that way. And then the last illustration, the patience of Job. And most of us have know a good portion or a good part of the story of Job. We'll turn to the book of Job, the first chapter. Most of us know what's going on in Job, or with going on with Job's life. In verse 1 of Job 1, it says, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and turned away from or shunned evil. Now you would think a person like this, how is there anything evil or bad ever going to happen to them? God, you would think God would protect that person from any kind of harm or evil. You would think God would put a wall around him and keep him safe. But that's not what happened. In chapter or verse 6, it says in verse 6, there was a day when the sons of God, and here's a little bit more about the spirit world, when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and the adversary, or as it says here, Satan, also came among them. And the Lord asked Satan, from where do you come? Satan answered, says, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? Have you looked at him? Have you examined Job, my servant? That there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and an upright man, one who fears God and who turns away or shuns evil. Well, Satan, as he had to Christ, as he had to Eve, had an answer for him. Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands and his possessions. Yeah, you would think that a person like that would be safe, that a person like that would not have any real problems, that a person that lives right, a person that does right, a person who fears God and walks away from and turns his back on evil, shuns evil, you'd think that person would be protected of all people. But the Lord said, well, Satan said in verse 11, stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. The Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not harm his person. And, of course, we know what happened. Verse 14 through 19 says what he lost. He lost his oxen, verse 14. And then he lost all of his sheep and all of his camels. And then, on top of that, he lost his sons and his daughters. In verse 18, while he was still speaking, another one came, another messenger, and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. Suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. Now, yes, you might think that Job would have cursed God and died. You might think he would have said, well, I give up. I did everything I could. I tried to live right. I tried to obey God. I tried to stay away from evil. And I feared the Lord. All these things. I was blameless. And look what happens to me. But that's not what Job did. Verse 20, and I hope that if such a catastrophe would ever happened to me, that I could have the attitude that Job had here. Job arose, tore his robe, and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground, and he worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin, nor charge God with wrong. I've sort of felt that that's one of the great verses in the Bible, the attitude that Job had in the face of all the adversity that he faced. Blessed be the name of the Lord. I came naked, I came from my mother's womb, and that's the way I'll return. God gave and God has taken away. That's fine. Well, you would think that that would be enough, but it wasn't. Chapter 2 relates another part of the story where Satan, same thing. He came back to God and he said, God asked him, have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him on the earth. Satan answered and said, yeah, skin for skin. He doesn't have any skin in the game, but now he will. Skin for skin, yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. Stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. Say, well, God told him you can do it, but spare his life. So Satan went and struck from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with boils from his head to his toes. covered completely all over with painful boils, so that he had to take a potsherd and scrape himself while he sat in the midst of ashes. You would think maybe his wife would encourage him. You would think. She's about the only thing he has left. But his wife said, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. Curse God and die." But Job said, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity?" Shall we accept good but not bad? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. In all of this, Job kept his integrity, and he still believed in God. Well, we know what happened, how Job's three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, came and tried to comfort him, and they were very poor comforters. And then Elihu, the youngest one, there was a fourth one that came and did the same thing. We know all of that. And they really had some interesting things to say. They were, you could tell that they must have been, including Job, quite educated. Job is thought by many to be the oldest book in the Bible. And as such, we think of them as pretty primitive, but if you read the book of Job, they knew a lot of things, some things that we've only maybe discovered or figured out in the last 100 years or so. They knew a lot of things about the earth, about the natural order of things, and about the universe, the sky, and so forth. If you read it, you'll find that Job, excuse me, and his friends knew quite a bit of things. But we'll turn back to, chapter 38, to conclude this part with Job. 38, and we'll just mention here that the Lord answered Job. Finally, this was all over. And the Lord answered Job, and he said, "Where were you? Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth?" In chapter or verse 4. Where were you? And he goes on to ask Job a lot of questions, and he said, "Tell me if you have understanding." And he asked Job, he said, "I will question you, and you will answer me. When I'm done, you can answer me." Well, Job did have an answer in verse 42, and it was a humble answer, because Job was a little bit on the self-righteous side. And it's, if I were had the character and integrity of Job, maybe I would be too. I have nothing to be self-righteous about, but maybe if I were that good, maybe I would be. Job answered him chapter 42 and in verse 5. He said, "I have heard of you now by the hearing of the ear." I've heard of you, which we hear a lot of things. "But now my eyes see you." Remember, Christ said quoted an Old Testament, some Old Testament scriptures, "Seeing thou shall see, but not perceive." Well, he perceived now. He saw. He said, "Now my eye sees." I understand it now. I understand a lot better than I did through the adversity he experienced. The testing he went through, his patience showed. He made it all the way through the end without cursing God, without giving in, and without sinning with his lips, as it said. And at the very end, then, it said in verse 10, it said, "God restored Job's losses when he prayed for his friends." He restored all that he had. Said actually he had more than what he started with. This third illustration is the patient endurance through suffering. Sometimes that's the hardest thing to do, to have patience when we're suffering, when we're sick, when we're otherwise having extreme problems, whether it be with jobs, families, or whatever. Those are some of the hardest times to have our patience. But when we look, when we think about all that happened to Job, most of our problems and issues tend to diminish because Job lost everything. And on top of that, he was suffering with extreme pain from the balls he had. But he had patience. The patience and perseverance of Job. Waiting on God, as we read in James, having patience is not an easy thing to do. It's not that easy. We have to work at it. We have to develop patience. Farmers have patience to see it through. They have to have, or they won't get a crop. But it takes effort to bear that fruit that they're going after. Prophets have to have patience for the long haul because they may never see the fruits of their efforts, or it may never come to fruition what they're preaching about, what they're prophesying. Job, we learn about the patience that Job had by looking at his life and what he did, how he responded. We can take little things away from that and learn to have patience like Job did, even in the midst of extreme suffering and deprivation. I know, yes, the 49th day. Let's turn back to Acts, the first chapter. Acts, the first chapter. And we'll play a little game of what if. Again, verse 4. Being assembled together with them, he commanded them to depart from Jerusalem, but to wait. What if the disciples had given up on the 49th day, and the 50th day had never really materialized for them? What if they had done that? Where would they have been? They would have said, they could have said, nothing to see here. I don't think it's going to happen. Let's go back where we were. Let's go back to doing what we did. We have friends who have done that. We have people we know who have done that, have given it up, and I don't know what they're doing. I hope someday they'll be back with us. There are lots of people who have done that, who have given up before the end, have given up prematurely. Where would they have been? Where would we be if they had done that? Who knows how that would have affected things if they had decided on the 49th day, we're quitting. We just can't do it anymore. It's not going to happen. And we don't want to wait on God. Where would God's plan be if that had happened? If they had said, that's it, we're going back on the 49th day. But what if? What if we give up on the 49th day, on our 49th day? What'll happen then? Where will we be then? And where will God, our part in God's plan be? Because God is counting on us to have the staying power, the long-suffering, the patient endurance to make it through to the end. We didn't read it, but Daniel 11:35, I think it is, it talked about some people that had to go through a lot of things just to purify them. Some of them with understanding, it said, would have to suffer to purify them. But God is counting on us, and he has a part. He's making a part in his kingdom for us, his people today. And if we give up on that before we get there, what's going to happen to that particular ministry that he was preparing for us? We'll close with Matthew 24. Matthew 24. And when we get discouraged, think about the 49th day. Matthew 24, it says in verse 9, Same thing that it said in Daniel 11:35. It says, verse 9, "Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Many will be offended and will betray one another and will hate one another." Boy, we see a lot of hatred in the world today. People hating each other and killing each other and across the whole world. Verse 11, "Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. Because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold." We have seen a lot of that. We have seen the love of many growing cold. Here is the point, though. "He who endures to the end shall be saved." Think of the 49th day and make it on past the 49th day.